Don't frighten us by telling us the facts. 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 We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on May 12, 2019, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Nate join me to talk about recent debates on breaking up big tech monopolies. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again this week is Nate. Hello, Nate.
Hey, Bill.
And joining me on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Nate.
This week, we're going to be talking about breaking up tech giants, something I think we've touched on in previous episodes, but it's back in the news this week with proposals from various people like Elizabeth Warren and also people who co-founded Facebook. So Rachel had suggested this topic, and it's a great one. And then also because of the fact that there was an Uber strike last week, I think a lot of people are thinking about that as well, as that's a similar company occupying a similar space and also branching out into other arenas. Rachel, where do we start on this?
So earlier this week, Chris Hughes, who was the co-founder of Facebook and a former employee, wrote an op-ed for the New York Times saying that it's time to break up Facebook, and Facebook has just grown too big and is out of control and is not being reined in by the current laws against monopolies and trusts. So I think he left Facebook in 2016, prior to the election. And he is really just kind of saying that he likes Mark Zuckerberg as a person. It's not personal, it's business. But the influence that Mark Zuckerberg has, because all of Facebook's power is kind of concentrated in him, is staggering. And there just aren't the checks and balances that is needed, because he controls 60% of voting shares on Facebook's board. And so basically every decision goes through Mark Zuckerberg, and he alone kind of decides how Facebook operates. And that's just too much power for one person to control, because Facebook is such a huge part of the internet and really controls what people see when they use the internet. Some things that Chris Hughes mentioned were the Cambridge Analytica data leak, where it was shown that people had hacked into Facebook and had access to tons and tons of people's private data. The fact that Facebook knew that there were bad actors that were trying to influence people's views politically and didn't really do much about it. The fact that there are so many people working as independent contractors as Facebook's kind of censorship board. People are viewing hours upon hours of violent and disturbing content every day, kind of determining what gets to stay on Facebook as quote unquote free speech and what is just too outside of the norms to be allowed on the platform, and how these people aren't treated well because they are independent contractors. They're poorly paid. Aren't really allowed to take mental health breaks. They just kind of churn through these poorly paid workers and then just kind of get rid of them, just breaking people basically. So Chris Hughes is saying that it's just too much concentrated power. There's a decline in entrepreneurship, higher prices and fewer choices for consumers because Facebook has kind of become so big they can just acquire or even copy other people's technology. So they acquired WhatsApp, a private messaging service, and Instagram, the photo app. And when Snapchat was kind of appeared on the scene as a their ephemeral messaging service, I guess, Mark Zuckerberg told his engineers to basically just copy Snapchat's technology. So they have just kind of stifled innovation and growth. We just basically need to break them up to kind of spur that innovation again.
Nate, your initial comments on this?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like this has sort of been talked about for a while. But the fact that we actually have one of the co-founders, you know, like there are pictures of him with like young Mark Zuckerberg or whatever in their dorm room at Harvard. And, you know, him making these kinds of arguments, sort of going in depth. And I guess he works for the Roosevelt Institute now, so maybe this is not too surprising. But sort of going along with the, you know, Warren type arguments, it's like, oh, to ensure like a safer capitalism, sometimes you need to break up the biggest monopolies and ensure a flourishing market, like we did with, the Ma Bell and Standard Oil and all these other railroads. And
hard not to question the premise of the, you know, the ultimate value of breaking up these companies for the purposes of a competitive marketplace when they seem to inevitably glom back together again, which I guess is sort of the democratic socialist critique of social democracy, right? One of them.
Yeah, so didn't they try to buy Snapchat back in 2013, and then Facebook like basically made something called Stories, which is like a copy of Snapchat basically. Like, I haven't used Facebook and all of its features and stuff for a while, but it seems like they've sort of tried to copy a little bits and pieces from all these other like social media networks, like trying to take Tinder's features and stuff. And so it seems like they're sort of scattershot. They're all over the place. I think in one of these articles they talked about, there's like, they have a specific like effort to clone basically other apps and just use their features instead. So I think there's been some bipartisan interest in breaking up Facebook, or at least checking the power of monopolies, including presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar and also former presidential candidate Ted Cruz. So I don't know if they're calling necessarily to break it up or at least more oversight. So it seems like there's an emerging consensus that there should be at least some more oversight, but I think Cory Booker was pushing back up against the breaking up Facebook. He was saying, oh, that sounds like something Trump would do, to point at one company and says, oh, well, we've got to get rid of it, you know.
Well, it was funny, though, because, yeah, they were asking him about that, and specifically Elizabeth Warren's proposal, and he said, as Nate said, that sounds more like a Donald Trump thing to say, like, I'm going to break up you guys, I'm going to, no. And then this interviewer, I think on ABC, says that he just compared Warren to Trump. He said, I most certainly did not, which is a sort of classic Cory Booker thing of just taking a weird contrarian position against any sort of regulatory oversight of anything in like the financial adjacent, you know,
or just saying mean things about bank capital.
Right. And then getting all offended when he gets called out on it. So, yeah.
Well, his presidential campaign is going great right now. So,
yeah. Rachel, what's sort of the next thing we need to be looking at here?
I believe, Nate wanted to talk about Uber. So there is a Washington Post article talking about how Uber doesn't really see themselves as strictly a rideshare business. They really want to become the Amazon of deliveries and of transportation. So they just want to become this behemoth, this ubiquitous company that is responsible for transporting goods all over the country.
Owning their own actual like equipment.
Right, exactly. So I guess they just want to have a ton of independent contractors that they wouldn't really be responsible for like benefits or fair payment or just treating them well in any on any level, I guess. So there's a venture capital founder, Gene Munster, who said they're thinking about moving things around more broadly, including humans. So they want
to makes them sound like human traffickers, but okay.
Yeah, that's a really odd way of putting it. He said Beyond Eats, which took in $1.46 billion in revenue last year, he also pointed to shipping under Uber Freight, which lines truckers up with loads to ship to destinations across the country. Just how well they can maximize the routes is critical. So I guess they want to use their mapping data from the ride-sharing app to kind of optimize these shipping routes and these trucking routes.
Which basically means that there's going to be 18-wheelers going down side streets, just like there are, you know, Uber vehicles navigating down side streets to avoid the traffic jams or whatever.
Which seems really, really terrible and ill-advised. And the fact that truckers are, like, I feel like their jobs sound more and more precarious as time goes on with automated vehicles and just kind of the squeeze that they get from their companies to run their routes as fast as possible while also following the law for driving duration, mandated sleep breaks and whatnot. So they're getting the pressure here, and you just know Uber's not going to treat their quote-unquote workers, but I guess independent contractors, well at all. And so it sounds like disaster is waiting to happen. So I would be very, very concerned if Uber did successfully move into this shipping industry like they want to do.
Nate?
Yeah, another part of this article I thought was mind-blowing, which I just noticed now as Rachel was talking, was that their Uber Eats, which accounts for about 13% of their revenue as of now, you know, is currently competing with all the other delivery apps, you know, your Foodlers, your Seamless, Grubhub, all of them. But they think that they're trying to do a revamp of the division called Eats 2020. Washington Post reviewed.
That's who
document.
I'm voting for.
Yeah, exactly. But regular customers, this is the vision, that who today average 1.5 orders a week on Uber Eats could be compelled to order 19.5 meals weekly, suggesting nearly every meal would be prepared and delivered to them by Uber.
What do they mean by compelled?
Just that it would be so good that they just, you want to order. Wait, you're ordering breakfast for Uber? Like, I don't understand. That's a lot of meals per week. You can't order delivery every single meal. I guess
they're
the
saying
of the
you
future,
can.
But
Uber Eats 2020.
Yeah, so that's their vision. Just constant Ubers pulling up, dropping off your food, and then leaving. And then, of course, it goes into the massive cash burn required to basically subsidize like the fares or whatever. And
yeah, I mean, none of the actual finances of any of this adds up at all. Like, it's all about trying to completely dominate the market until you can have some sort of total monopoly or whatever, but of course even then it's not really going to work. The whole thing is going to be a house of cards that comes crashing down once they get to monopoly status and suddenly realize that part of the reason that they've been able to make this work was not because they were slightly undercutting, you know, the competition, but because they were
massively
undercutting the competition. And if you raise the price at all, you know, beyond maybe a couple dollars, that people will just be like, no, thank you. I'll go back to the other way of doing it.
They also had Uber Rush, which was like Amazon Prime style, like same day delivery of everyday goods and services. But that was shuttered after it launched in 2015. So, but it basically seems like they're just like getting like data. They're telling restaurants that don't order hamburgers in neighborhoods that don't have any nearby burger restaurants, like, oh, you should make burgers. It's like, okay, thanks for the input, Uber. I don't know. But of course, then there's also the human toll that this basically takes. I talked to a bicycle courier for Uber Eats. Jonathan Muzon, 34, at Brooklyn, said the job involves long hours and brutal winters for little pay. Going out in the frigid cold to do it is just hell. Your fingers will go numb if you're outside for too long. You have guys who have gotten so creative they have these big mitten gloves on their handlebars. He said he would bring in a insulated bag from another app to keep food warm while in transit. So you've got guys like working for like a couple different apps just like delivering food and like the freezing cold and, you know, getting frostbite or getting hit by cars or whatever. So,
and of course, I mean, I jokingly made reference to, although it's not much of a joke, about 18 wheelers ending up going down side streets or whatever. But like, even if you're not talking about the freight shipping, you're just talking about, you know, you mentioned that they had had this attempt in 2015 to do sort of like everyday goods and services delivery. Yeah. But between these food delivery things and Amazon's ever increasing doorstop delivery of stuff, you know, 24/7 practically, not quite, but getting there.
Yeah, they're doing freight.
Traffic is just traffic is just going to be horrible in all suburbs and major cities.
Right. So here's the thing: I see
unbearable
because Lyft had their little like logo on the front of the car, and then Uber started doing that too to like compete or whatever, or like label themselves. So now you see those cars everywhere, pretty much, and like apparently in some areas they're undercutting public transit. Because it might be more like quicker instead of like walking from the station to like where you have to go or whatever. And then, so, you know, this is having effects. So, and we're not really cutting down on congestion or whatever at all.
No, it's actively adding to congestion to have all these things. You know, if people were really getting every meal of the week delivered,
that's insane.
And they're getting their Amazon Prime stuff delivered every few hours, you know, every day or whatever by those white delivery vans that you see with the Amazon logo everywhere. Like, yeah, I mean, it's insane, but it's also just that it's an unsustainable level of traffic and congestion and stop start and everything else. And it's just absolutely horrible. And like, you know, I guess then we sort of arrive at a much larger philosophical question about whether are we going to try to find the best way of doing this on the basis that people want this? Or are we going to start telling people that they can't have everything they want? And I, you know, that's a difficult conversation to have. But I mean, that sort of goes to the larger, like, ecological questions as well about, you know, whether you're supposed to be trying to provide prosperity to everyone, which, yeah, I mean, to some extent, yes, for sure, no question. Or the more hardline position of, like, you know, oh, what we should be doing is self-denial and everything and cutting down on our sort of footprint in the world or whatever. And that I think is you know, that's a more hardline position that is harder to get buy-in for socially. But I'm not commenting either way on that particular question. I'm just tying together the different, you know, themes here.
Yeah, although there's probably a middle ground between like living in a yurt and like ordering every single meal on Uber Eats or whatever. So, but maybe we should talk a little bit about the Uber strike this past week. Was it Wednesday?
I think major
U.S. cities, they struck and they're, you know, getting out and protesting. There was protests, I guess, outside of the Uber headquarters in San Francisco, right, you know, downtown there, basically talking about how they're making very little money. You know, he's been working for like 6 years and he's been getting less money now, so...
Didn't they try to change the like pay formula or whatever of what sort of percentage and mileages and stuff people were getting, how they were getting compensated? I think that put some pressure on people.
But there were, they shut down the apps for 12 hours, drivers in Detroit, Boston, Atlanta, Chicago, New York, San Diego, San Francisco, as well as in other countries as well, Melbourne, London, Sao Paulo. So it might have been the largest gig worker strike to date. And as that's becoming a larger part of the economy, that's going to be increasingly significant to watch any labor action.
Yeah, I mean, everything is contractor-based in this economy. And part of, you know, as other people have said, this is not coming from me, but other people have said this, like, part of the big promise to all of the investors, you know, taking endless losses on these companies in their quest for dominance is that they're going to fundamentally break and reorganize the entire economy around like gig contracts and stuff like that that are very difficult to unionize, and that is, you know, how they're gonna outcompete everything else, you know, and disrupt the conventional providers of similar services. They're just, you know, they're gonna make it so that you can't unionize anything because everyone is so effectively so atomized. So it was interesting to see them, you know, do a collective action on this scale. Rachel?
Boise was not part of that strike, so I didn't really get to see how that looked up close. But it like you said, it's really interesting to see how gig workers can come together and do this collective action. I saw a lot of kind of derisive commentary, so I hope it was successful, but I guess we'll kind of have to see how that kind of shakes out in the next few months or so, and see if that actually did make any difference.
Yeah, there were a lot of people on Twitter that were very insistent that to participate in the strike at all was, I don't know, some sort of discrimination or something. Like, you know, it was very online on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Wokeness.
Yeah, well, you know how Twitter gets into these little loops about everything.
So, but I mean, that's just to be expected. So, now, Rachel, you put another article on here about the Amazon cloud computing services, web services, and the Oracle lawsuit with the Pentagon.
Let's circle back to that, because Rachel, you had brought up this that contextually one of the big things to know about this issue of breaking up the online, you know, the Facebook and Amazon type companies is that they. It's not just that they have a strong lobbying presence, it's that they have very strong ties into the government itself at this point.
Yeah, I guess it. I don't know how well known it is, but Amazon Web Services actually basically runs most government websites. So on Gizmodo, a reporter tried to do a week without the big five. So Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, let's see, what was the other one?
Microsoft.
Microsoft, yes. So she took a week without each service, and basically Amazon was impossible because Amazon Web Services is just the runs most websites. I think she said the accountability agency for the government is run through Amazon Web Services. Netflix, HBO Go, Twitch TV. So I don't think that's something that's really known about. Just the fact that even though the internet was invented by the government, we've just kind of, I guess, privatized it and allowed Amazon Web Services to control how we use the internet. So related to that is the Pentagon had a contract to... for a $10 billion contract for cloud computing for the Department of Defense. Amazon insiders basically worked with the Department of Defense to tailor write the specifications for the contract. So while they appeared to have an open competitive contract process or bidding process, Amazon really got to write the specs so they could be basically the only one that could fit the bill, which really isn't that uncommon in government contracting. You write the specification so specifically that only one person can fit it and they get awarded the contract. So this contract is called the Joint Enterprise Defense Infrastructure Program, aka JEDI. Our American military really likes to make jokes out of their acronyms and seem kind of lighthearted, like with Star Wars, especially, it sounds like. But this JEDI program is a 10-year contract up to $10 billion that would have the Pentagon using a single cloud provider for much of its general computing needs. As Amazon blows its competition away in the cloud computing market, not just in market share, but in the number of features its cloud offers, it has for a long time been considered the frontrunner to win the contract. So Oracle sued, saying that two former Department of Defense staff members involved with the deal had ties to Amazon, which created a conflict of interest that unfairly tipped the scales in favor of Amazon. Their most serious allegation was against Diab Ubi, who was an Amazon employee before he came to work for the government on the JEDI contract process and then rejoined Amazon afterwards. This is from a Business Insider article. Basically, they're kind of saying that Amazon is probably going to win this anyway, but Oracle is kind of providing a much-needed obstacle to kind of slow down the process and ensure that more people are aware of this conflict of interest and kind of the interrelatedness between Amazon and the Department of Defense and how they're really buddy-buddy and really... working hand in hand to make this deal and how it's not actually as competitive as they want to make it appear.
And, you know, we've talked about before, I think, on the show, you know, Amazon's acquisition of companies like Whole Foods, and that has sort of, you know, concerned people in terms of their sort of spreading presence across various different markets and industries. But to go back to what we talked about at the beginning with proposals from Chris Hughes or from Elizabeth Warren, et cetera, about the sort of the tech monopolies itself just within the tech realm. I mean, other people have pointed out, you know, that it is kind of a problem when you have the Washington Post owned by the owner of Amazon or maybe owned by Amazon. I'm not really sure the exact ownership there, you know, and writing articles in favor of the Department of Defense and the NSA and the CIA, which they probably would anyway. But, you know, now that, you know, those companies, I mean, those departments and agencies all using Amazon Web Services for their cloud computing and all of that, you know, it's all very incestuous and everything. And it just shows that, like, the sort of overall market dominance of everything now by companies like Amazon or in some cases Facebook and Google, you know, it's like it's really spreading into a lot of areas that we're not expected to affect, you know, in our lives. Yeah.
Nate? Yeah. Didn't Zuckerberg and former Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, there was a New York Times op-ed or whatever where they were very indignant.
Did an indignant rebuttal to Chris Hughes calling for Facebook to be broken up. So, like, all of these, you know, Nick Clegg, former Deputy Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, like, they're the omnipresence in government and of government people or former government people and politicians in these companies, like, it's just around and around and around. And so it seems like very difficult to envision actually managing to break up these various companies. All right. Rachel, thanks for bringing this topic to us this week.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
And Nate, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.